Advice from those who know on how to pen an unforgettable memoir. Glance at a few bestseller lists published in the past decade, and you'll see that they're almost always peppered with memoirs. Memoirs have not only become wildly popular with readers, they are also pretty popular with writers and aspiring writers. Some are hoping for a major publishing deal. Others just want to share their memories with friends and family. Here in Maine, memoir writing workshops fill up and have waiting lists. Maybe you are one of those people thinking of signing up for one. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll have a little workshop of our own with three fine authors who have published successful memoirs. We'll ask them what they think about before they get started writing, how they come to terms with difficult memories or privacy issues, the difference between truth and fact in memoir writing, and more. Maine Calling tells all, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. By their very definition, memoirs are books any and all of us can write. And here in Maine, it seems like a lot of people are putting pen to paper or finger to laptop to collect and share stories from our past. Today, we're going to hear from three memoirists and learn what it takes to write a good memoir. With me in the studio, Elizabeth Peavy. She is author of My Mother's Clothes. Helen Pepe is author of Pigs Can't Swim. And Jed Coffin is the author of A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants. We invite you to join our conversation. Are you a fan of memoirs? Are you thinking of writing one? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thanks for all three of you to be here today. This is going to be a really fun show. And Elizabeth, I'll start with you. In addition to being an author, you've taught memoir writing classes for a few years now. You say even before they were called that, right?
We didn't really know what to say when we were teaching these. We'd talk about writing in the first person or that catch-all creative nonfiction. The memoir moniker sort of came a little later. So
what accounts for the popularity, do you think? Why do so many people want to write memoirs?
I think because we're all naturally storytellers. We all are memoirists every day. You know, when we have an adventure, we want to tell our friends about it. But I think because there's such a proliferation of memoir out in the market now, people keep tolling the death knell for it. It's like memoir is dead, memoirs run its course, and yet they just keep coming one after the other after the other. And I think people sort of feel like, well, you know, I had an experience or I have a story to share and I want to do it too.
Do either Helen or Jed, do either of you have thoughts on why they're so popular?
I think people like to understand themselves. It's kind of like a self-examination. So I know that was one of the reasons I began to write it, was to try to see, you know, who I am at this point in my life, like a midlife crisis kind of thing. You have to go back and figure it all out. And, you know, it's fun. It's fun to figure it all out. Scary, hard, but fun.
Scary, hard, and fun in one yes. thing. And what about you, Jed? What are your thoughts about? You've also taught classes.
Yeah, I've taught a great deal. You know, I don't know. I think for me, I can just speak for what makes me want to tell my own stories. I think there's a lot of, you know, ego involved. I really enjoy having a medium through which to kind of.
So you're like the greatest thing ever? Is that?
Well, yeah, you got to be. You know what I mean? You got to really value your own story in a way that warrants spending hours and hours and hours and hours trying to tell it. I mean, there's not really any way to justify that, you know, in the real world. So I think we just like kind of holding ourselves accountable to who we are and beating our drums, you know.
Helen, your new memoir, Pigs Can't Swim, is doing quite nicely on the local bestseller list. Congratulations. It is about your unconventional childhood in rural Maine, from what I've read so far. Why did you write it? And how do those you wrote about feel about your writing it?
That's a big question.
Two big questions.
I began to write it not intentionally. It happened because I was in an MFA program, Stone Coast, and I was writing a different book about losing weight. And the mentor in the program I happened to be working with, Deborah Marquardt, happened to say that I couldn't really write the memoir I was working on, naked, finding my feet, until I figured out my food issues. So her assignment to me that first semester was to go home and try to figure out why I had all this food hang up with chocolate and meat. So I went home and I wrote a chapter, and it was a chapter called The Killing House. And then I couldn't stop. And the first memoir got shelved, and I just went on and on and on. But I did not write that memoir thinking that it would be published. I wrote it for myself. So the whole family piece of it came in much later, and that was that.
So you wrote it, and then somebody said to you, you know, you should publish this. And then you had to go to your family and say, I'm thinking of putting this out there?
Well, actually, I didn't go to my family. I kind of kept it secret. And when people asked me what I was writing about, like my mom and dad, I would say that I was writing about animals and food. And we really didn't talk about it as a memoir. I didn't tell them about the memoir until I got a contract and we knew for sure when it was coming out. Two of my sisters knew all along because I went to them to verify facts and what was going on in my life when I was little, because they were so much older than I was. They could remember stuff that I couldn't, historical facts, so that I could get timelines right. And they knew. And one of those sisters really said, yes, you know, get it published, because an agent had come to Stone Coast at the end, and she had read a piece of it and said, I'd really like to do this. And it just totally took us all by surprise. And so then at that point, I took a ton out, thinking my family would read it. I took a lot out, like by half, and rewrote with the idea that my family would be reading it and I wouldn't want to hurt people. And I had to balance what I was going to leave in and changed identifying things. But that whole first Pigs Can't Swim was a raw telling, leaving nothing out, no distance on anyone.
And your agent and the publisher was okay with that, that you went back and sort of changed it a great deal.
Yeah. And actually, I had to have a legal read. I had to have two legal reads. And so even after I took out a lot of
stuff.
Now,
what does that mean, a legal read? I can guess by what you're saying, but.
When memoirs are done, somebody has to read it, a lawyer, to make sure that if anybody is feeling especially litigious, that they don't sue me for slander. And so there were parts of Pigs Can't Swim and several areas that were marked, so I had to change them. In some of those areas, I changed the actual concrete language to using things like, this sibling might have done something, you know, just reworded it. In other areas, I had to change who said what and who did what just a little bit so that I wouldn't offend anybody or get into trouble.
Well, why don't I ask you, Liz, the same question? How did My Mother's Clothes come about? And is that a memoir, or is it something else? I know it's now a play as well.
First of all, it's My Mother's Clothes Are Not My Mother. I refer to it because it takes so many words to say. It started life as a memoir. And as I was working on it, these monologues just kept bubbling up and saying, say me aloud, say me aloud. And I had been up in a borrowed space in Bethel, and I came back to Portland, and I called Deirdre at the St. Lawrence, and I said, you got a night in September? This was May. And she said, yeah, I'd love to have you come. And I just figured I would read some of the excerpts. It turned into a show. The show turned into 2 years of my life. And now I'm trying to put what was on the stage back into the book, which anybody who was looking for advice about writing a memoir, don't do any of that. Don't do any of that.
Don't stage a monologue. Don't stage a
don't
play.
Don't start a book, turn it into a play, and then try to turn it back into a book. It's hard enough.
And it's going to be staged again
this
spring.
It is. I'm bringing it back to the St. Lawrence for two performances in June. I haven't done it in Maine for a year and a half.
Helen used the words hard, the word hard, among others. I'm guessing this was pretty darn hard as well.
For all very the same reasons, when you are dealing with your own personal stuff, you know, there's chances that you're taking when you're putting information out there. When you're dealing with other people, it just puts the ante up so much higher, especially if they're not here to defend themselves anymore. This is not an indictment against my mother. My whole
right.
point of the show is sort of we all did the best we could. But nonetheless, if I talk about the fact that she wore a wig in 1970, you know, she would be rolling in her you-know-what. So she doesn't have that opportunity to defend herself. So every word, every example that you use, you weigh and measure and weigh and measure and say, do I have to say this?
Mm.
And you answer that question. And my cousin said everybody wore wigs back then, so she sort of exonerated me on that point.
Well, good. You can sleep well then.
Yeah.
And Jed, tell me the story of your memoir, A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants. How did it come about?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Brunswick, and my mother raised my sister and me right downtown. And growing up, we frequently went back to her village in Thailand, in eastern Thailand. Every year for a while until my grandfather died. And then when I was 21, after my junior year in college, I went back to the village to become a monk, which is something that about 80% of young men in Thailand do, but which obviously is very exotic to Americans, you know. I think the reason why well, there are a couple of reasons why I wrote the book. One is, you know, I was just in a writing mode. I was 27 when I wrote it. But from basically the day I finished college, up to the point where I, you know, signed the book deal for A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants, I'd been writing every day, and, under no idea of what it meant to be a nonfiction writer or a memoirist or whatever. I just knew that, I wanted to write. I'd read some books, some novels that, are not memoirs by category, but they are deeply autobiographical. So, you know, On the Road, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, those are books I read in high school. Wonderful high school teachers at Brunswick High School who put those books in front of me. And I saw those as autobiographical stories, coming-of-age stories. And so those were my models. You know, you write about yourself and you examine the kind of the country or the world that you live in, try to make some meaning out of it. So I'd written a lot of books that were more or less copies of those stories. I did a lot of hitchhiking in my 20s or even before that, and did a lot of kind of soul searching as well. And so I kind of copied Portrait and On the Road in some ways, a lot of Hemingway work too, I got really into. And then I started writing more seriously. I was a student at Stone Coast MFA, where I now teach, and met an editor who, you know, I told her about these really important stories that I thought were my kind of junior varsity opus, you know, works. And she said, well, you know, we've kind of heard those stories before. What else you got? And I said, well, I have this. I was a monk when I was 21, and without really having written any of it, I said, you know, I'm working on a book about that as well. And it's really coming. It's really hot. You know, you got to pick it up. And her eyes lit up, and she's like, that's the one. We can make that a book. You know,
and then you thought, uh-oh.
Yeah, and I thought, all right, better start writing it now. And you know, that's the I think there was a moment in 2008 where, you know, it's often listed as an ethnic memoir. I think those stories were really important, still are, but there was a trend for kind of stories about multicultural families, you know. But for me, really, the deeper spiritual reason why I wrote that book was I didn't really get what my youth and boyhood had been about. I had all these memories of a faraway place, of people who look very different than the people I grew up with in Brunswick, a culture that was very foreign to the main world. And I think I needed to set the record straight and figure out what it meant and give it a name and a face and a story to let it sit in my head the right way. And it did that. And now I look back on the book, and I would have written it totally differently. But for the time being, it gave a name to something that was nameless.
So is it overstating it to say that the act of writing, writing a memoir can change you as an individual? I mean, can it be transformational?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that Helen said is, you know, that we sort of write to discover who we are, what our processes are. I think writers don't know who they are or what they've gone through until they've written about it. I think that you are transforming yourself every time you kind of relive and reorganize your thoughts about experience. I don't think you can help but do that.
Right, I agree. The reframing it over and over, the deciding what to put in, what to take out, and the deciding what to take out is really freeing, because you get to understand that maybe that wasn't as important to drive your story. And, you know, the one of the things that I like now that I've done it is that I hope people take away from my memoir that you can look back and find humor and lightness and try to make sense of things that were crazy and have compassion.
I want to talk about, before we go to our first break, about the whole concept of truth. A few years ago, I was shocked to learn that many memoirs, including some very famous memoirs, have been embellished a great deal. I'm not saying anything about yours. This is somebody who's a national, somebody who lives somewhere else. but how accurate does a memoir need to be? And are you entering at some level into a contract with your reader when you write one?
Well, that if you don't mind, because this is the central core to everything that I've been teaching. I teach a course called The Best Truth. When you're teaching memoir, when you're writing memoir, one of the things that's really essential to understand is that we start reconstructing experience the minute it starts happening, that memory and imagination start fusing together and we embellish and sometimes improve upon what's happened to us. As long as you're engaged in that consciously, that you're not creating, recreating, inventing, lying, and you create that relationship with your reader, that there's an understanding on the page that I am telling you what I remember to the best of my ability. It's just like meeting someone at a cocktail party. You know, you can say, oh, yeah, all right, you know, and head back for the punch bowl.
Right. So for you, that's the standard, that as long as you're being honest with yourself and you honestly remember it this way. But if you start embellishing it because you think you're going to get a book deal that you might not get otherwise, that's going down a different path.
It's called fiction. Basically, I mean, you know, if you can't tell the truth outright, you know, again, you know, there's certain levels. David Sedaris, for example, and I always use this as an example. He openly embellishes. He openly bends time, bends orders, makes things funnier. And no one expects any differently. There's even a term coined Sedarian. You know, it's like he said it's sort of truthful. But when you're especially bringing in other people, you better have all your facts straight. I mean, things that can be corroborated, you should corroborate. But memory is subjective and slippery. So, you know, we remember what we remember and we recreate what we recreate.
Do either of you want to weigh in on this idea?
Yes. I look at this from the view of all the photography I do. I'm a photographer, a horse photographer. And what I've noticed is that honesty is separate from truth in that it is just a piece of it. You can be 100% honest, but you can't have the complete truth because there's too many perspectives. And talking with my family about this and just, you know, I watch people out there. They don't know what's going on around them. And in this society now, people aren't even usually 100% committed to conversations because they're holding cell phones in their hands. So in order to know the truth of everything that's going on, you have to be superhuman to be able to see everything from all the different perspectives. So we have to reach the truth that we can reach through ourselves and knowing ourselves. And in that way, we can be honest. And as long as you're honest, there's not any problem. And that honesty conveys that we all have different perspectives and our memories are shaped by who we are and who we are at that very moment. Because every moment we're a little different, and those scenes that we take in are going to mean something a little different to us as we grow.
Jed?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think I have a somewhat reckless perspective when it comes to this question because I know it's been a weird, like, philosophical fulcrum in the genre for a long time because of some, you know, aberrations on what's what we think of as truth, what we as a culture are comfortable with. You know, you can dig through my work, any of the journalism I do, and you know, the quotes are backed up by notes, right? And that's just kind of the standard. But, you know, I've known a lot of storytellers in my life, and I like them. And I like – so I think of all the different ways that you can tell a story and circumstances under which those stories can be told. And I had this memory that that is kind of the parable for how I understand how I want to tell stories. I was with my dad up at Chimney Pond in Baxter when I was 11 years old. And there was this guy, a couple guys. They were mixing gin and tonics around the fire. And, you know, they were in their 40s or 50s. And they got really drunk and started telling stories about their lives. And obviously, I was sober. And I got to watch these guys around a campfire get more and more drunk and tell these crazy stories. And as the night wore on, the kind of amplitude of their storytelling just, I mean, kind of exploded. And I remember just being totally entertained and blown away by the volume of how these men wanted to narrate themselves into existence. You know, I don't think those are the words that they would have chosen when if I asked them what they were up to. But and I just love that instinct. You know, you don't have to be drunk to do it. But I just think obviously. But I just think there was something about the way that that those men that night approached storytelling that made me realize that you've got to bring that kind of and I say this in a metaphorical way, intoxicating energy to the way you create your own mythology.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Sweetser, seeking mentors for children with mental and behavioral health needs. Learn more at sweetser.org.
Alan Cumming is reprising his role as the MC in the new Roundabout Theater Company revival of Cabaret. It's his third time in the role. He won a Tony in the 1998 production. On the next Fresh Air, he'll tell us what it's like playing the MC as he approaches his 50th birthday. Join us.
That's coming up at 7 o'clock on Fresh Air here on MPBN. May is Life is Better Month here at MPBN. You count on MPBN for so many reasons, and MPBN counts on you. If you make a donation to MPBN during May, you'll automatically be entered into our Life is Better contest with a first place prize this year of a new Nissan Juke S donated by Lee Auto Mall. We have two second place prizes of a summer weekend getaway for four with golf at Sugarloaf. No purchase necessary, void where prohibited. Full contest rules are at mpbn.net. Click on support. May is Life is Better with MPBN Month.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Memoirs. With me in the studio, Helen Pepe, the author of Pigs Can't Swim, Elizabeth Peavy, author of My Mother's Clothes Are Not My Mother, and Jed Coffin is the author of A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Going to start off with Theo in Brunswick. Hi, Theo. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I actually went to school with Jed.
Hey, Theo. Theo Leveris.
Yes.
It's been a while. It's been a while. That's Maine for you, huh?
my question is, I have a cousin. He decided to go have adventures and write a great American novel. His heroes are Hemingway and Jack Kerouac, and he got down to about North Carolina. He got robbed. He was living homeless. They took his computer, his phone, all his money, and he basically cut off communication with everyone at home who could help him. So he's out there on his own, literally on his own, trying to survive as opposed to, like, writing. And I was wondering if you had any advice for kids who are trying to head out there and do the same thing and so they don't end up in the same situation.
Yeah, you know, I've got all sorts of advice. But you know, who needs advice? One of the things that I always tell people, especially young writers, when I speak in front of young writers, is I say, you know, people are going to tell you that in order to become a writer, you need to starve, or you need to read the great Russian novelists, or you need to whatever. I think for me, the most essential piece of advice I have is you need to try to get along with your parents, like in your kind of late teens, so that you can live with them in your early 20s to like write. You know, that's what I did. I got a lot of flack from my buddies, who all of whom are now living out of Maine, for living at home at my mom's house. But I got a lot of writing done then, and it didn't cost me much. So you know, hope maybe he can your cousin there can find you know, a way back home, or find a family that'll take him in for a little while. I've settled all my debts, I hope, but there, you know, the question of how you make it work. You know, I've got a 12-day-old baby right now, and I'm here, and then I'll go home and write for 3 hours, and I got to make money somehow tomorrow. You know, it's just a never-ending cycle of hustling. I love it. It keeps me kind of alive, you know, in another way.
I'd like to jump in just as someone who did that, who got in her car and drove 13,000 miles by herself and slept in her car and in rest areas and surprisingly, I'm not dead in a ditch. There's a difference between having adventures and wanting to be a writer and writing. And, you know, the idea that you have to get in your car and go, you know, someplace in the Badlands to find your ideas is very romantic. And if you read all those books that we've all read, then that's how you sort of picture yourself as a writer. But I never started being a writer until I put my butt in a chair and put my fingers to the keyboard. So the romance of the writer, being a writer, and writing are two very different things.
Do you think maybe there are people out there who just, they want to be a writer, they'd love to write about their own experience, but they don't feel as though their own experience is worthy?
Yes.
I mean, and how do you assess whether, you know, Helen, you wrote about a child, your childhood. How did you at some point realize this is worthy. This is worthy of putting out there, putting on a library bookshelf.
I think every writer, everyone who, and we all still do it now, we wonder who is going to want to read about our lives. It's our responsibility as a writer to make it so it's about everybody's lives. And so that's what I thought as I was writing, is that there will be something that people can take away from this book that will be important to them, and they'll be glad that they read it. And maybe they'll be a little better for it. Or maybe they'll be a little worse. But it will affect them. It will change them. Because that's why we read, is to be changed. And it's all about the human condition and the human experience. So everybody has something that can help someone else. So everybody can be a writer if that's what they want to do. But you have to sit down and actually write. You can make up a jillion reasons why you don't have time to write. And when you're writing with a 12-day old baby, you know, slamming it all in whenever you can, that's, you're a writer, you know. And I have two kids and, you know, another full-time job. And it means getting up early and going to bed really late and just writing as much as you possibly can.
Theo, thanks for your call. Going to Alex in Sanford. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'd like to inject a little thought kind of on the side for those people who feel that they really would like to write about their life, to record it, but do not feel that they are of publishable quality, if I could put it that way. And that would be to write a journal. And I have for more than 40 years. And I can say to my children, would you like to read about when you were born here at home? And of course they say yes. And all of their life is in there. And so for the question that was just mentioned, is this worthwhile to someone? The answer is, of course, it is of value to your posterity. Would you like to read your grandmother's journal when she was a little girl your age? Oh, yeah. Well, we don't have one.
And is there, you know, and Alex, what about a hybrid? If you have not been keeping a journal all your lives, and I'm sure Liz and Jed, some of the people
right
that
now
you teach classes to, their goal is not to be published, but just to write something for their family, right?
Or just to get their, you know, some of their personal histories down. You know, again, the first thing that because I teach, you know, general interest memoir, and I say, you know, do you want to just document your experience? Do you want to share it with others, or do you want to share it with the world? And that kind of, you know, decides where you're going to, what level you're going to start at, and how are you going to cast your stories. But the other thing, I think people get overwhelmed. It's like, I'm 80. I can't tell my whole life story. Well, describe your grandmother's kitchen. You know, start there. You know, leaving something is better than leaving nothing.
All right, Alex, thanks for your call. Going to Steve in West Terrace? West Paris. Are you calling from West Paris, Steve?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you for the show, by the way. I'm about 12,000 words into a memoir that I think is compelling, but I have heard that memoirs should run about 50,000 words, and I think the most I can get out of mine would be 25,000. And I was wondering, would there be a market for something like that?
Mm-hmm. Are there rules about length?
Well, I think that it was Steve that we're talking to. Mm-hmm. Steve, I one of the forms that we haven't really brought up yet is the personal essay, you know, and a personal essay is, and, you know, you can just Google personal essay and get more about that than you'd ever want. But if you look at the personal essay form, they're kind of mini memoir pieces, I suppose. Those do exist in that 12,000 to 5 to 12,000 word range to 20,000 words. And you know, the second thing I have to say about that is if you feel like you're coming under what is a sufficient length for a memoir, you probably just haven't spent enough time with your story, and have someone read it. Have a sibling or a friend read it, and just and they're going to come up with questions. And I think your job as a reader is to address those questions. I mean, as a writer is to address those questions. So,
okay, well, good luck, Steve. Thanks for calling in. We have a Facebook question from Bob. Can memoirs become a movie or short film? What makes memoirs work for film? Thoughts?
Sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
We hope they'd all be movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, what are some memoirs that have turned into films that have been successful that you feel like?
Well, Angela's Ashes was a film, wasn't
yeah,
it?
And, yeah.
And This Boy's Life was a film.
Right.
And Wild is going to be.
Yes, right.
I mean, obviously the list goes on and on, yeah. But I think that there's a relationship to memoirs that are crafted in such a way that they have a cinematic quality to them. I don't know about, this is one thing that, this is a question that fascinates me, but when I close my eyes and try to remember something, I see pictures. And so when I talk to my wife about this, she doesn't see stuff. She feels stuff or has kind of other relationships, but I see pictures.
Mm.
And so I always feel like I should have been in the movie, you know, should have been a right. movie writer because I see images. But I'd be curious to see what, when you guys drop back into your memoir mode. And
right.
Try to
so
recall
many
the
memoirs
past.
Are episodic. So
yeah.
it would make
yeah.
sense that
I
way.
I see scenes.
I
know
see
what I mean?
Scenes.
Yeah.
Definite
yes.
scenes.
And smells and the whole thing. I mean, it just bubbles right up for me.
Right.
But I think in the movie question is so many narratives, and probably the Steve's problem is that he is thinking just narratively that I've got to get this story down. This really
right.
cool thing happened to me and I've got to tell the details. And the whole nature of memoir is slow and a lot of it is internal, which does not translate to the film. I mean, you've seen those movies mm-hmm. where, you know, the narrator comes in and says, yes, and then I was thinking about, you know, and it's just they're
right,
hokey
right.
and they're awful. But the ones that have the strong narrative thread and they're the adventure, you know, like Wild is, you know, perfect because it's got that beginning, middle, and end, and it's like this happened, then that happened, then this happened, then that happened. Whereas a lot of the best written memoirs are the slow ones where they're contemplative. They're not rushing a reader to, you know, flip the pages, but to sit on the page for a while and think a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's death for movies.
Mm. Okay, another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, introducing Tarnation California-Style Lager, a new year-round brew in cans and on draft. BaxterBrewing.com.
A perennial business problem. How can companies improve on productivity among their workforce?
What we've done is add a number of additional sensors to these ID badges.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, tracking employees. What could possibly go wrong? We'll have that story for you and the day's business news. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APN.
Join us for Marketplace tonight at 6:30 here on MPBN. Coming up at 1 o'clock on our Public Affairs Hour, ideas from the CBC, bioinvasion, attack of the alien species. Millions of YouTube viewers have seen the jumping carp. It can weigh up to 100 pounds, leap 10 feet in the air, and hit you square in the face as you paddle your canoe. It's just the newest in a long line of celebrity alien invaders. Ideas examines the phenomenon of invasive species, a story as much about human nature as about nature. Looking forward into the week on the MPBN Public Affairs Hour at 1 o'clock, Tuesday, the Commonwealth Club of California looks at the Goldman Environmental Prize at 25 years old. Wednesday is our TED Radio Hour. Thursday, ideas from the CBC again with Fragile Freedoms, the global struggle for human rights. And on Friday, Speaking in Maine takes us to Waterville and Colby College for a panel discussion on techno-snooping, privacy, technology, and the evolving rule of law. That's this week during our Public Affairs Hour here on MPBN.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, All Things Memoir. With me in our studio, Elizabeth Peavy, author of My Mother's Clothes Are Not My Mother. Helen Pepe, the author of Pigs Can't Swim, and Jed Coffin, the author of A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Going to Marcia in Ocean Park. Hi, Marcia. Go ahead.
Hi, I am living in Ocean Park, Maine, and I am been writing my father's memoirs, who is a Russian immigrant who had written his own memoirs after he came to America, where he escaped from the Russian Revolution. And so some time ago, I found an old cardboard box filled with his original writings plus about 100-page manuscript that he started to write in an effort to release his bad memories. My question is my manuscript is almost finished. How does one go about finding someone to publish or someone to read it who can give you direction as to where to go now?
Well, I would say that the first thing I would do if I wasn't part of a program, like an MFA program, is I would join Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance and talk to them about finding a group, a workshop, anything that where you can go and talk about your stories and sit down and have people read them and start to network with different writers. And once you start doing that, and you'll get so many ideas. And you can also get Poets and Writers Magazine and start sending out sections and stories that you think would be good enough. And sometimes editors will give you some feedback that will help. And that you just never know who you're going to talk to, which direction they'll send. And be a believer in the ripple effect and in a lot of hard work.
And we'll put a link to the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance on the Maine Calling Facebook page for you, Marcia. It's a terrific organization and great advice. Thank you, Helen. Going to Megan in Rockland. Hi, Megan. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. I'm calling because I wanted to kind of point out another way to write a book. We're not all writers, but many of us are storytellers. And this is something I help people to do as a personal historian by interviewing them and bringing out their natural storytelling instincts, like the men that he mentioned telling stories around the campfire, and that by using the interview and creating a book from the words that they say during that, it's, you know, doesn't have to be something that you publish for the big world, but something that your family and friends might find really valuable to have the stories. I mean, wouldn't we all love to have grandma's stories?
That's interesting, Megan. And is this your career? Is this your profession?
Yeah, it is.
And are there others, or is this something you've learned from someone else, or an idea you came up with on your own?
Well, it a little bit of both. I was working with a historical society here in Maine, the Swans Island Historical Society. They had lost everything in a fire, and they needed to somehow regain their history. And so I interviewed many of the residents, and we created a huge photo collection, and a book came out of the experience. And it's been really valuable for them to have those stories and their history. And so I realized I was doing this, and then I discovered that there's an Association of Personal Historians, and it's an international organization And there are people who help people, to ordinary people, to write their books or create family history videos, things like that.
Well, interesting. And feel free to post something of your own business and from the Association of Personal Historians on the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thanks so much for calling in. Going to Eddie in Belfast. Hi, Eddie. Go ahead.
Hi. This harkens back to something you talked about earlier about telling the truth in the memoirs. And I'm just wondering if any, and this is a question for any of the guests, if any of them, based on coming up against some of that frustration or concern or looking over your shoulder, has made them think, boy, you know, I should write fiction because I get to use all the tools in the toolbox. Mm. Have any of them felt like that's a way they want to go down the road?
Sure. Fiction's wonderful. And there are many times I thought that I would write my memoir as fiction. And it is very freeing, and I just finished a fiction that I did, and it feels wonderful, but there's not as much self-discovery that way when you do fiction, when you can start to go outside of everything. When you have to stick to what really happened, it's, like I said earlier, it's scary, but it's also really exciting to find out so much about yourself. Once you really start thinking about your life and working on it and making stories out of it that work, it beats fiction.
And my problem is if I try to write fiction, I don't know what happens next. I haven't been able to figure that part out yet. So
I just can't. My imagination is dull compared to things I've seen in the real world. You know, I think it's for the kind of writing I do. I try to put myself in uncomfortable places, not necessarily dangerous, but places where I feel like I don't belong or most of the world doesn't want to go, emotionally or spiritually or logistically, physically. And I mean, it just gets weirder and weirder the more time you pay attention, you spend paying attention to how people exist. You know, I've seen all sorts of wacky things, and the minute I try to make them up, they just feel made up.
And they always say truth is stranger than fiction. Eddie, thank you for your call. Going to Sylvia in Weston. Go ahead, Sylvia.
Hi. My question is similar to the last one, but I'm calling to ask if you have or your authors have any experience with people who have actually written a memoir and then just published it as fiction to avoid the litigation process on it. Mm.
I considered doing that, and my editor said I couldn't, and my agent didn't want me to do it. It means more to the reader when it's truth, but also if you try to write it as fiction and then people see themselves, find themselves in it, then you can still get in trouble even if you said that it wasn't true, because...
So there might be reasons to write a book as fiction, but to avoid litigation isn't necessarily the best one, right? So thank you, Sylvia, for your call. We have a really interesting Facebook post, and I think you'll like this, Liz. Hi, it's Amy in Locks Mills, and I'm thoroughly enjoying today's program. Thank you. I want to thank Elizabeth Peavy for inspiring the formation of my writing group, which grew out of a two-part memoir class she taught 3 years ago at the Norway Library. Five of us have continued to meet monthly to critique, support, and inspire each other, and I can't imagine my writing life without this group. Since our class... with Elizabeth, I've been working on a book which, while it doesn't technically meet the definition of a memoir because it's written from the point of view of my mother, it was inspired by that workshop.
Aw. My work is done here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think this is interesting because her memoir class met at the Norway Library. We're not talking about somebody who's a quick drive into Portland or somewhere where there might be university classes. Can a group of people who like to write get together and give each other valuable feedback, even if nobody's had anything published, even if nobody is, a so-called expert?
Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, I've been teaching all over the state, from Lubeck to, the Norway and down south. The way that I put up my memoir workshops is that I really am casting them off. I give them critiquing techniques. I give them feedback. I give them things to think about so that they won't need me. These are 1 or 2 day workshops that I do through MWPA. But I have often found that people get together and form writing groups afterwards because they, I mean, these memoir workshops are so intensive and you create relationships and people want to maintain those relationships afterwards. But as long as you have a good foundation, I don't think it's helpful for a bunch of novices to get together and just read their work. But if they have a good foundation and then can go with that, absolutely. And that's the best way. As Helen said before, just be around other people. Let them read your work. Hear your words out loud. Get feedback from other people. It's the best way to become a writer.
Well, and we have a related Facebook post from Robert. What about the reader, I choose to ask, should the person be well endowed with the English language or, should the person be well endowed with the English language, a subjective or objective slant? How do you find the right person? How do you find the right reader for your memoir? Helen, you said a couple of your sisters?
I wouldn't say they were the right readers. Family's really a hard one to read your memoir because everybody, when they read it, they're looking for things about themselves. As soon as they start page one, they're waiting to find out what terrible thing you revealed about them. So family can't look at the memoir as the bigger picture in the wider world. They can only look at it very selfishly, which is fine and very human, and it can offer you a lot of good feedback for how the world might see it, but they're not your best reader. And your friends, you know, are good sometimes, but sometimes friends will just say, yes, I love it, love it, love it. And that's not really valuable either. The best readers are the ones who can read critically and give you honest feedback. So we're right back to the honesty and truth question again. And I think that when any reader reads it and is honest and has questions, that it's the writer's job to then go back and look to see if they answered those questions. And maybe their point was not to answer the question, but to leave that a little open. And that, again, is part of the writing process. And sometimes they want the reader to have that little ambiguity as they're writing it. But, yeah, readers are great, and they don't have to be literary, and they don't have to be your best friend, and it's probably better if they're not. Just people who have been in writing programs would be good.
I'd also like to plug MWPA again because sometimes you get beyond just, I want my friend to read it or I want something that you need professional eyes on your manuscript. And there's wonderful resources there when you get to a point where either you're stuck or you don't know if it's done or you need editorial guidance. All sorts of wonderful professional readers in the state to help people.
And I should mention, there's many authors who will read your book. You can hire authors who have memoirs out there or have novels out there who will be more than happy to read and critique your book.
Great. So we have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you all what you're working on now. Jed, I'll start with you.
Sure. I am just in the process of finishing a book called Rough House Friday, which is a story about the year I won the middleweight title of a barroom boxing show in Alaska. So that's been about a...
That sounds like a unique story.
Yeah. It's not exactly monasticism in Thailand. But I've been hacking away at that for maybe 5 years. I disclaim that with, I'm in the process of raising two daughters at the same time. So I wrote my first book in 9 months. It was a total fairy tale. This has been rugged. I mean, the amount of research I've done, and I feel like I've just kind of cranked up the stakes of the kind of work I want to do.
And so. Helen, you have just finished a fiction novel.
I did. It's for tweens, so I did, and it was fiction, and it was a lot of fun to make it up. And
do you know if it'll be published?
It's with an agent right now, and she's going to be sending it out here in the next few days. So that's the exciting stage. It's been through a lot of revision, worked with her on it. And I'm also working on a sequel to Pigs Can't Swim.
Great. And Liz Peavy, you're working on your show that's opening in 2 months?
I'm trying to – I relaunched it last February. So that's sort of up in the back of my mind. But what my big project for the rest of this year is to get the memoir finished, the book that started this whole thing. And it's with an agent in New York right now, too. So I've got the working manuscript, but there's many, many, many miles and pages left to go. So,
well, thank you all three for taking the time from your incredibly busy schedules, especially Jed, you with a newborn. Wow. So for being here on Maine Calling today, Helen Peavy, the author of My Mother's Clothes Are Not My Mother. Helen Pepe, the author of Pigs Can't Swim, and Jed Coffin, the author of A Chant to Soothe Wild Elephants. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer, Cindy Hahn, answered your calls. Jonathan Woodward ran the board, and we had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, what options do graduating high school seniors have aside from going to college or going to work? Join me for a conversation about gap years, apprenticeships, trade schools, and beyond. And if you are one of those people taking part in our Maine Calling Book Club, next month's book is a classic we are going to read. John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. That was a drum roll right there. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.